regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed.
185,000 pages.
Now, public accountability and transparency, there will be no public support.
Is this really the best we can do?
If there's a regulation that doesn't make any sense, why do you keep
it? Do you know who wrote the regulatory laws you must comply with?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
On February 24th, 2022, Jerry Brito and Una McDonald joined the Regulatory Transparency Project to discuss cryptocurrencies, money, trust, and regulation. The following is a recording from that event. We hope you enjoy.
Hello and welcome to this Regulatory Transparency Project webinar. Today we will be discussing Dr. Una McDonald's new book, Cryptocurrencies, Money, Trust, and Regulation. With all the historic events that are occurring in the world and the dramatic geopolitical and financial implications, it's our great fortune to have a very insightful guest join us this afternoon. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I am Vice President and Director of RTP. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of our guests. Today, we are happy to have Jerry Brito join us to lead the discussion. Jerry, how are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're again happy that you could carve out the time to join us. Jerry is the executive director of Coin Center, a nonprofit research and advocacy group focused on public policy issues facing cryptocurrencies. He has previously informed many policymakers throughout the executive branch, including the White House, and has been called upon by Congress to testify regarding cryptocurrency. His scholarly research and articles have been well received and prominently published. Jerry is also a friend to RTP, and we're very pleased, again, that he could be with us. As indicated, we are also thrilled to have Dr. Una McDonald, CBE, with us today. Dr. McDonald, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Again, just very, very excited to have you with us. Glad that you could carve out time for us. I'm sure our audience is well aware of Dr. McDonald, that she is a senior advisor for Credo Capital. She is a former British Member of Parliament and an international expert in financial regulation. She's previously advised authorities in a number of countries, including Sri Lanka, Indonesia, Ukraine, and Moldova. She is the author of numerous articles and 7 books, including her most recent, which provides the basis for today's discussion. If our audience would like to learn more about both of our guests, you can visit our website, regproject.org, where we have more complete bios. In a moment, I will turn it over to Jerry. Once our guests have had time to thoroughly discuss our theme, we'll go to audience Q&A. So please think of the questions that you'd like to ask. Audience questions can be submitted via Zoom using the raised hand function. If you raise your hand, we'll do our best to call on everyone in order. With that, thanks very much to you both. Jerry, I turn the program over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Nate and RTP, for having this. And by the way, thank you very much to Susan Dudley for suggesting that we have this conversation. So, as you said, Nate, we're here to discuss Dr. McDonald's new book, Cryptocurrencies, Money, Trust, and Regulation. And I thought what we'd do, Dr. McDonald, is I'm just going to ask you a series of questions to bring out the substance of your book. And along the way, you know, I'll probably challenge what I imagine will be some of your theses that I read in your book. So I just to kind of level set, tell us, what is your book about?
It is about, it starts, of course, with 2008, with the introduction of Bitcoin, understandably perhaps in the middle of the financial crisis, when typically in America, I think more so than in other countries, distrust of the central bank and distrust of financial institutions at a high level, I guess that affects the latter affected everybody during the financial crisis. And what he sought to do was to provide an alternative currency, which was not dependent on any intermediaries for transactions from one person to another. And he designed this using blockchain. I think elements of blockchain had already were already in existence, but it was the way in which he thought that could be used. And what interested me was that the word honest kept occurring despite his attempts to make this a purely automatic transfer, which not requiring any human intermediaries, who of course are either honest or not honest, or honest sometimes, not honest at other times. But that word kept cropping up again. And so you have to understand, try to understand why he thought that could only be used with reference to a node, but a node is a computer. And then the computer has to be programmed by someone. So to me, it did not actually ultimately remove human intervention, however hard he tried. And then you have to go on to consider, what is money? Bitcoin failed as a currency, despite its being legal tender in El Salvador. Very funny business, that. And so then people were worried, particularly about in extreme volatility of Bitcoin intraday and from day to day. And so they introduced the notion of stable coins. Stable coins are linked, maybe linked to gold or platinum, or they may be based on an algorithm designed to alter the supply so that the reference to a fiat currency could be retained. And sometimes, and most importantly, I think, of the stable coins are the ones that are directly one-to-one exchange, usually with the dollar, but also with the yen and euro in particular. And then, of course, there are lots of questions arise about particularly trying to turn that into a global stable currency, which we know is Zuckerberg's attempt. And I think it would be interesting to discuss further why that one failed, and stable coins in general. So I think it's better for me now.
Yeah.
You, because I've given quite a detailed introduction, so I'm sure there are questions that you want to ask me.
Sure. So yeah, so your book it covers cryptocurrencies first, then stable coins, and then towards the end also central bank digital currency, or CBDC. And you are critical of cryptocurrency and stablecoin and CBDC, I would say. So let me just say one quick thing about the honest. The use of the word honest in the Bitcoin white paper by Satoshi Nakamoto, which I totally picked up, was a driving issue for you. I don't think Satoshi Nakamoto ever claimed to or intended to take out human intervention from the system. By definition, you know, he was a human who created it, and the miners and the nodes were going to be operated by humans, and that was perfectly, I think, evident to him. I think his use of the word honest is the whole point of the, I think what he did want to remove, or at the very least minimize, was trust, the necessity to trust, and to trust the honesty of actors in the system. And the way that he sought to do that was by, rather than having to employ trust, one could employ mathematic verification of somebody's claim. And so that's what I think he meant by the word honest, right? He was trying to say, some people might want to cheat, and we can verify whether they are trying to do that, or they are indeed providing the real, attesting to some fact that you can verify mathematically.
Actually, I quibble with the term mathematically.
Okay.
Because it's often presented as solving a complex mathematical problem, and various descriptions of this work.
Yeah.
But that's where I think, in the UK, I'd call it a fruit machine, but I think I mean a slot machine.
Yeah.
And basically, you have to keep banging away until you find the right combination of numbers. And that is why, contrary to his initial expectations, so you could do this on your desktop, using free electricity from your household. Whoops, I wish that was the case. But of course, as you know, the computers have become more and more and more powerful, and the miners and the machines became more and more concentrated, at least until China has disposed of Bitcoin and the possibility of mining Bitcoin. I mean, the possibility still exists, but they don't want to use so much fossil fuel energy on on the very powerful computers. That, I think, is only a cover reason. Frankly, I think it's because the Chinese government wants to eliminate anything that could transfer money from one person to another, except through their CBDC. So that's the issue with Bitcoin. And it is therefore possible to have the 51% takeover, and could have been possible, certainly, with the Chinese concentration of miners.
So sure. So, and we're getting far afield, I think, pretty quickly. But when I say mathematically verify rather than trust, I'm not referring exclusively to the proof of work consensus mechanism, which is what you're describing in the, you're right, to the lottery system component of Bitcoin. I'm talking about simply using cryptographic proofs to prove, for example, that the Bitcoin that you are attempting to send, you have previously received, et cetera, et cetera. And I agree, it's not merely math, it's math and game theory, right? So the combination of the ability to use cryptographic proofs and the game theory of incentives, and you're right, that he did not foresee. I don't think he ever foresaw that this would be free. There would be free electricity. I think he did not foresee that it would be. He thought it would be one computer, one vote. People using. So he. But nevertheless, it doesn't undermine the design of the system. And I think we've seen since that you don't have to use a proof of work mechanism for consensus. There are other consensus mechanisms available as well.
If you have your private key and your public key, and as we both created very different difficulties.
Wait. Can you say that again? I'm sorry.
Private and public keys, and as you created other difficulties in people losing their private keys.
Yes, that's right. So it is. So your private key controls your funds. And so you want to be very sure that you don't lose that, the same way you wouldn't want to lose a $100 bill. But public private key encryption is something that has been around with us since the 80s, the 70s, well, I mean, for much longer than that, 70s, 80s, and undergirds much of our financial system today. So it's not something esoteric or exotic.
And used and upgraded.
Yeah.
An old cryptographic system. Yes, I'm aware of that.
Yeah. So let me ask you, what is your critique of cryptocurrency?
Basically, that I think it is not workable, ultimately, because of the volatility involved and because of transfers, which, as you know, have not increased speed, and they have been long and slow by comparison with other transfer mechanisms. And therefore, that one of the aims of Bitcoin hasn't turned out to be the case. That is why people moved on, partly why, one of the reasons why people moved on to alleged and using Ethereum and so on as the means of making transfers, so that these would be speedier and therefore more acceptable. So I think, and I think that has also been demonstrated with the shift in people's attitudes to Bitcoin, i.e. it's, well, apart from the criminal use of Bitcoin because of its anonymity, I think that that's why people have seen it as a speculative investment. And their dream when purchasing Bitcoin is that overnight they will become much richer than they were, but you have to pick the right day.
So I'm what I'm hearing is that your critique is not so much of cryptocurrency, but of Bitcoin in particular, because you're saying that Ethereum, for example, sounds to me like you're saying might be a more efficient or faster or speedier or better crypto system.
Recently, though, I gather Ethereum's technology is now considered to be rather old and becoming slower. Mm-hmm. But for people who wanted an alternative, really, I'm taking people through. Well, first we had Bitcoin. Then what was wrong with Bitcoin? The answer to Bitcoin was stable coins. And particularly those related to a particular fiat currency. I have to say, I don't particularly like them being called fiat currencies, because that to me is, we just make an announcement that this is a currency, whereas a currency to me is dependent on the management and nature of the economy of the country issuing its own currency.
So you'd rather call them like national currencies or something like that?
Yes. A fiat is just, it's a quibble. It seems misleading to me.
Okay. So this is interesting. I'm trying to really ascertain what the critique is. Because, for example, you say that first came Bitcoin, and Bitcoin proved not to be stable in value. And so therefore, people invented stable coins. Of course, stable coins, and by the way, there are many different kinds of stable coins. I think for purposes of this discussion, we should limit ourselves to the stable coins that you're addressing in the book that make up the vast majority of the market, which are stable coins backed by a particular currency or basket thereof, right? So stable coins, number one, provide a completely different function from a cryptocurrency. So I don't really see one as substituting for the other wholesale. And number two, stable coins depend on cryptocurrency networks. So something like USDC runs on top of the Ethereum network or the Solana network. So it depends on the cryptocurrency network. So they're not perfect substitutes.
No, I actually think it would be useful. I didn't really explore this so much in the book, to separate the Ethereum's, the various blockchains, because those certainly can have other uses. For example, if I can briefly give an example, very useful in Hong Kong with its trade finance project, where they found that a number of businesses in Hong Kong got the necessary loans for trade finance from more than one bank and then disappeared with the money. So blockchain became very useful for being able to identify straight away which company had borrowed from which bank. And once you knew that, other banks in the group who involved themselves in the project did not offer trade finance for that particular trade. As Bank A had already done it, so banks B, C, D, and E would not have responded. So I'd like to do that because I think it's quite important to separate.
And so did they do that on the Ethereum network?
Yes.
Okay.
Separate those out from the use that's typically made of them with the particular stable coins. And that's why central banks and others, and particularly for a wholesale market, are in fact looking at those networks for their speed and efficiency.
So that's interesting. Yeah. So again, your critique seems to be not of cryptocurrency writ whole, but of Bitcoin in particular, and maybe of Bitcoin because it does not manage to maintain stable value.
And then, of course, I do move on to criticisms about the ways in which stable coins And here I am referring very specifically to stablecoins that are dependent on a particular fiat currency.
Mm-hmm. You just said fiat, Dr. McDonald.
Just because we're all used.
Sorry, I had to catch you on that.
Oh, no, you're right. But I managed to substitute national for fiat in my that's subsequent thoughts.
Okay, so maybe we should move on and talk about stablecoins. I just want to say that there are any number of uses of cryptocurrencies beyond simply using it as day-to-day payments money. And I would say that that includes Bitcoin. Bitcoin has any number of uses beyond just day-to-day payments, which it's not really well suited for that. I would agree with you there. But on stablecoins, I mean, for example, Tether was probably one of the very first stablecoins, and it was first issued on top of Bitcoin. Today it mostly runs on top of Ethereum, but it was originally running on top of Bitcoin. And indeed, you have a lot of development work, especially led most recently by Block, formerly known as Square, to develop sort of the kind of advances that you see on Ethereum on the Bitcoin network. But going to stablecoins, what is your critique of stablecoins?
Right, it's the thing that you mentioned, Tether, as Tether gone to suggest that it is one-to-one. The dollar. First of all, I have to say, I really have two questions to which answers have been given in the past. And the answers involve financial inclusion. No. And there are other ways of ensuring financial inclusion. I would say that America is probably the country, advanced country, that's least up to speed on that, although there are payment systems in the process of development or extensions of them, such as PayPal, which is now possible to use for international transfers. So financial inclusion, I just mentioned briefly that the UK has done very well by making banks it's now a legal obligation on the leading banks to provide basic bank accounts. And that means that the unbanked households, there are about 28 million households in the UK, that only 250,000 where no one in the household has access to a bank account. And so there are other quicker, simpler means of doing that. I think the EU has followed that process as well, but it's much more difficult to get the numbers of as to how effective that has been. And secondly, cost. Well, you see, very often with a stablecoin, some exchanges allow you to exchange dollars for their stable coin, their dollar stable coin, without cost. Many do not. And you still have the cost of exchange rates, transfers, and the person at the receiving end in some other country may not be able to do this. This was one of the reasons that Zuckerberg offered for his stable coin, first Libra and then Diem, dependent on a basket of currencies for which he failed to get a license from the Swiss regulatory authority called FINMA, which didn't surprise me greatly. I never expected him to get that, partly, but not only, because FINMA had 20 central banks consulting them. And I would add another point here, that given the way in which Facebook has misused people's personal data and sold it in days gone by, there was a lack of trust there. No one trusted Zuckerberg to have that degree of power, which, assuming that all his Facebook followers, WhatsApp and so forth, all bought Libra or Diem, then that would have given him a huge market. But I think his interest was really always been in data and the use of data. So anyway, that's one.
Agreed on that. So maybe we can get back to Libra in a minute. But first, you know, you mentioned, I guess what you're saying is that there are claims on the part of stablecoin issuers that this will help with financial inclusion. And I agree with you completely that financial inclusion is really not a technological problem, let's say, in the developed world, certainly not in the United States. There is a relatively small number of unbanked people in the United States. And they are, if you look at Federal Reserve surveys, they're not unbanked for lack of access. They are unbanked by choice in many cases. And we can then discuss what can we do about that. So I think that when stablecoin issuers make claims about inclusion, I would hope, what I imagine them to mean and what I hope they would mean is that they're thinking about global inclusion. And so there are parts of the world where there isn't the same kind of access, where perhaps because people don't have identification, people don't have local providers, there isn't access, but yet they probably do have a smartphone. And as long as you can get a free software wallet on your smartphone, you can receive cryptocurrency or stable coins, let's say dollars. So that's a kind of inclusion that this certainly makes available.
Yes, but I think here you really need to spend much more time looking at India, which has provided people with identity extraordinarily quickly, their bio-identity. And people have their mobiles, their smartphones, very cheaply, and they buy a new SIM card, which you can buy apparently at every local shop. So that has made a huge and interesting difference. So I think...
I agree completely, right? So when you have a government with the will to create the conditions for that kind of access, but there are places in the world where there is not that kind of government, whether there's a will or not.
I'm not quite sure. Externally, one can do a huge amount about that, but
no. But by virtue of having access to smartphones with connections to the internet, they can now have access to financial transactions that they wouldn't have before.
That is widely and cheaply available too.
Yes,
may not be too keen on doing that.
Yeah.
Let's move on from that, because my way of approaching stable coins. First of all, I do think that they are simply parasites and their value rises and falls with the management of the economy of the particular currency that they have chosen, national currency, shall we say. And what I would do with stable coins by way of regulation,
yeah,
looked at both the president's working party, no, I wouldn't be initially anyway, trying to regulate them as banks.
Mm-hmm.
And the FSB, his latest report is much more, I guess, of a, how can I say, sort of slightly hand-wringing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've been talking about this for 3 or 4 years now. Why haven't you done more?
Yeah. So that's interesting. I completely agree with that. So you mentioned Tether earlier, and your main critique there. Excuse me?
Tether has had a difficult history, shall we say.
Yeah, and so your main critique there is that there's no assurance whatsoever that Tether is backed one-to-one. And indeed, as far as I'm aware, Tether is not supervised by any authority.
Okay. In the British Virgin Islands.
Okay.
Headquarters is registered.
Yep.
I have not been able to ascertain, and I have read in the press, a blank denial that it is registered by the small regulatory authority.
Right. Yep.
So that's what I would do with Tether. I said, okay, if you're going to be sold on exchanges here and in other countries as well, this is what you have to do. Your website must show various things. First of all, it must show where the company is headquartered, who are the senior executives, how do I contact you if anything goes wrong. Then it must also state, so there are 2 points. There's a second point about payment services that I will come on to, but first I want to exhaust this point. The second point is you must explain in clear and simple terms exactly how and how certain you can be that you can redeem your dollars, your stable coins for dollars at any time. And this applies to all the stable coins, by the way. So I'm not making an exception for Tether here. The third point is that you have to have full, not an attestation. Attestation is worth to just pay someone to give you an attestation.
Yep.
Or take the fees and run, but where's the proof? So for that, you need full accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Covering the reserves and the profits and the losses that you have made. And then, as I said, it may not even be as fast as originally claimed, because it appears that some of the blockchains, the technology needs updating in some way.
So my question about that is, I mean, the way I read the state of the regulatory landscape in the U.S., essentially everything you just outlined is the law already here. And so is the fact that there is this question of risk related to Tether an indictment of stablecoins, or is it an indictment of the authorities in the United States? Because Tether is available to Americans. It's available at major exchanges here. And, you know, short of a little bit of inquiry on the part of the New York Attorney General, federal authorities, the Treasury, at the SEC, have done nothing about Tether.
Exactly.
So is that really an indictment of stablecoins, or is that, because I then look at something like USDC, which is the second largest stablecoin after Tether. Tether is like $70 billion in assets. USDC is like 50, something like that. And USDC provides everything that you've just described and is licensed in all the states in which it does businesses, et cetera. So there's a distinction there, right?
Yes, there's a distinction there. My only concern, I think, with that particular one is Binance is part of their operation.
Of USDC?
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
Anyway, that's my problem. Yes, why not apply it? And I think if all of that was made clear, and let me say that I don't think Tether is in a hurry to provide any such transparency. It hasn't so far. Only has got as far as attestations. That applies to some of the others as well, I have no doubt. So I say, if you really think that the stablecoin is going to do anything for you, and you know exactly what you're doing, well, maybe go ahead. The only serious anxiety, I think, on the part of the FSB is the possibility of another global stablecoin, which is what Circle wants to introduce.
So maybe you can help clarify, because I'd only ever heard of stablecoins, and then there's this term global stablecoin. And so I'm wondering about these distinctions. Maybe, for example, you could draw a distinction between what's the difference between a stablecoin and PayPal?
PayPal is only a payment service.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, you
deposit a dollar with PayPal. They issue you essentially a PayPal dollar in your account, and they invest that dollar that you gave them into assets that are allowed under money transmission statutes, and they keep the interest. And at any moment, you or your counterparties can trade that PayPal dollar for a bank dollar back. USDC to me seems like it's doing exactly the same thing. So what's the difference?
I think my question ultimately for a stable coin is, what is the point? Why should I buy a stable coin in order to transfer money when, and here I think it's worth looking at the UK, which has, they are supervised and regulated by the FCA and are extremely clear. I've looked at a couple of their websites, and what you get on the website is you want to transfer X amount from your account, your bank account, to someone in another country. It will tell you, it gives the amount you want to transfer, the exchange rate, and the amount the other person will receive. And it's as clear as day and extremely simple and extremely quick. And I think there's no need for the invention of some other coin above that, except very simple international transfers of that kind. I'm aware of people who use these regularly in the UK to transfer money to India or money to France, and there you are, all done. So to me is, why am I exchanging my dollars for this coin, which of course doesn't exist?
Well, it exists as much as a dollar in your PayPal account exists.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is we've kind of shifted from a critique of the risk of stablecoins, maybe establishing that it's kind of a similar risk to PayPal, and we've moved to a, why should I use this? So what's the use case? So maybe they're not risky, or they're as risky as PayPal, and more of a question of, well, why do I want to use this? And so to that, I think what a stablecoin issuer would say is, if you use PayPal, you can only pay other people who use PayPal. And if you use something like USDC, you can pay anybody with internet access who is willing to download a free Ethereum wallet. And that kind of interoperability, you know, has potential. You know, whether it takes off or not, I have no idea, but I think that would be the answer.
Even so, I think you have to pay at certain points. Not on all exchanges, you pay to buy a stable coin. So why would you do that? When you can just put the money you just transfer the money from your bank to, I think the UK systems are excellent actually, into transfer, it was called TransferWise, it's now just called.
Yeah, these are competing systems. And so, Let's let the market decide, yeah.
It was, but I think Tether in particular is in a difficult position because it's yes. And that's why I would want to make Tether and other stable coins come clean.
Yeah, no disagreement there. So you mentioned Libra. What was the significance of Libra?
I think, well, the significance of it is it never actually got off the ground. I think the significance of it was mainly to central banks. And I think it very much was one of the major triggers for central banks looking at CBDC. And I just want to say very quickly, thinking about the way in which central banks, well, I have a lot of criticisms of central banks, but to make it using CBDC. But let me just take one topical one. If you want to eliminate cash, just think about what you heard on the news today.
Mm-hmm.
People in Ukraine are grabbing as much cash as they can for the ATMs because it is quite possible that none of these systems will be working because of the intention to wreck them through cyber attacks. And so I think if we want to think I just wanted to make that point, because Sweden very much looks at the decline, or central bank government does, looks at the decline of cash and thinks that that in and of itself is a good reason to have CBDC. I said, think about it again.
Yeah.
It's always necessary. And of course, there were signs, many indications that during the pandemic that people began hoarding cash as well because of their fears of the effects of the pandemic.
Yeah, no, agreed there. Maybe quickly before we run out of time and we move over to questions from the audience, let's talk about CBDC, which you just mentioned. I think we're probably going to be mostly agreed on CBDC. The U.S. already has digital dollars. Do we need the government to create a CBDC?
Oh, I don't think so. And of course, it carries risk with it. And there are two risks, depending partly on the setup that is ultimately in place, all too easily. And we need to look at why China has done it, which is, I shouldn't assume that that could just apply to China. But China is doing it because it gives the central bank access to everybody's individual accounts and what they spend on what. And could, from that point of view, be used as a much more effective way of monetary policy. When questioned on this in the UK in a select committee hearing, the chairman raised this issue, then the select committee raised this issue with the governor of the Bank of England, who of course said, well, no, you wouldn't want to use it for that. To which the chairman replied, maybe not you, but maybe later.
Right.
And that's very important. And then secondly, there is the effect on commercial banks.
Mm-hmm.
And we would squeeze commercial banks out of existence. And I think that's extremely dangerous, although people may not like the system in which the commercial banks create money. But on the other hand, the activities of the commercial banks, not only in creating money, but in lending and in lending creatively and with a true knowledge of what they were doing. I really don't think that there are occasions in which I would like to have been trying to get a mortgage from some bureaucrat at the central bank, or however, whatever way those propose to deal with such issues. So I think central bank digital currency, no.
Yeah. So I agree with you, but that actually leads me to think that I can imagine a world where it's not just China that adopts a completely surveilled, controlled central bank digital currency. I can see Western nations doing the same after seeing what, you know, the way that the Canadian government has behaved over the past few weeks with its engagement of the Emergencies Act, et cetera. It wouldn't surprise me if, you know, Chrystia Freeland would be perfectly in favor of a completely controlled and surveilled monetary system in Canada. And if that was the case, would I not want, as a Canadian citizen, an alternative to be able to transact in an autonomous and private manner?
If you could.
Well, you know, in that situation, I might try to take whatever I can and help to build it to make it as close to perfection as I can.
If you're in that situation, yeah.
Yeah, but it's probably best not to wait to be in that situation. But, I mean, the Canadians find themselves in that situation right now.
Well, I think it's just ended.
Yeah.
Yes, I've been following that one as well.
Yeah, not good.
I think also, again, there could well be the issue of trust.
Mm-hmm.
So long could we actually trust the other system, which might well be, as if we take DAO as a decentralized system, sort of. I can see something like DAO as a decentralized system. Actually, it's not really being decentralized at all. It's gone the path, or inevitably will go the path, that the Mutual Building Societies went in the UK. Nationwide still exists as a mutual. It operates here as well. But in fact, all the decisions are taken by a central management.
Yeah, that's something certainly to guard against. Okay, I see we have 15 minutes left in the hour, so let's take some questions. Please feel free to raise your hand if you want to ask a question. I see some that have come in on the chat. Let's see. I'm trying to find one that would be relevant. Let's see. This is from Chip Hartley. Once the existing central banking cartels develop their own centralized surveillance blockchain-based currencies, do you expect they will use their captured regulatory agencies to crush independent crypto competitors that can evade those panopticon control structures? It's a pretty loaded question, but I'll let you answer it. And please raise your hands if you want to ask questions. I think it'd be much better if you just came on and quickly asked your question. I guess if I could rephrase the question, how much of a threat do you think central banks and other government agencies see crypto as being? Do they see it as more of a consumer protection challenge that needs to be overcome, or do they see it as a legitimate threat?
I think actually with Diem, they saw it as a threat. And I said that that was to a large extent because they could see the enormous number of potential participants that Zuckerberg would have, and also because of the lack of trust in Zuckerberg. You have to actually believe that and we do this. I mean, we offer each other, as I like to say, colored bits of paper in goods and services, and we believe we're going to get what we paid for as far as the exchange of colored bits of paper or a string of numbers in our bank accounts. And I think because of Zuck's, his potential misuse of all of that, not trusted. Now, Circle, which would like to establish a global currency, has its chief executive, Dante Disparte, who was the vice president for Libra stroke Diem. So I guess what he's looking at very carefully is, where did my previous boss go wrong? And can I achieve a global currency, a global alternative currency, but much more carefully?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I certainly saw that concern when Libra was launching, that it would, you know, present such massive scale given Facebook's scale. But this was typically said by people who also saw no point to stablecoins and did not understand why anybody would use it. So it's kind of like a mismatch. If you think this thing is useless, there shouldn't be any demand for it, then why would you be afraid that it's going to have billions of people using it? And also, to be honest, I never, and even if you thought there was value to stablecoins, I mean, Facebook has had digital payments. You know, they've had Facebook points and Facebook dollars forever, and they've had no take up. And then lastly, I would ask you, You know, you just said in the book, you say this, that this was Facebook's coin, that this was Mark Zuckerberg's plan, et cetera. But of course, understanding that that would be a criticism of them, what they did was to not make it theirs. They initiated the idea, but they created a association, the Libra Association, composed of a couple dozen firms, and they were aiming to have 100, including Visa and Spotify and Uber. I'm sorry, I think you might be, I can't hear you.
Visa and others dropped out pretty quickly.
Yes, absolutely, after they saw the political backlash. But I guess, so, I mean, what Facebook and Zuckerberg, I think, tried to do in order to address that very concern that they could foresee critics having, that they had a deficit of trust. In order to mitigate that, what they did was to say, hey, we're going to make ourselves but one vote in an association of many other independent companies, like Visa's independent, PayPal's independent. They were all members. We're going to make ourselves one vote in this association. Do you think that that was all a facade and all these other companies were going along with whatever Facebook and Zuckerberg wanted?
I think a number of companies thought that this might really happen, and so they'd better join and examine competition. And then, as you rightly say, when they saw the political backlash, and I think looked much more closely at the way in which the Libra Association would run and what powers it would have and how it would establish the reserves. And I looked at one or two of the members and I wasn't convinced that they had the necessary skills and experience of banking and what they were doing. So I think that the whole thing, having, as it were, alerted central banks to such a possibility, saw it off, basically. I think the relationship with FINMA helped to see it off.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. So there's a question from Jeffrey Wood. He asks, or he says, I believe I've heard financial regulators say that it's actually easier to trace transactions involving crypto, even allegedly anonymous blockchains like Bitcoin. And I would quickly say Bitcoin is the furthest thing from anonymous than traditional currency, paper, specie, or even checks, especially if they get a cooperating intermediary. The Silk Road itself is quite a cautionary tale. Do either Mr. Brito or Dr. McDonald agree on or disagree with this assessment?
I think it's not as easy to break into blockchain and to identify those holding the private key or the individual Bitcoin tends to be very concentrated in a few hands, so we gather. I'm not quite sure how anybody really knows that, but that's what is assumed. I think initially, and for some long time, it was not quite as would really have been very difficult to identify the holder of the private key. I think in the as time went on, but regulatory experts have found it possible but time consuming to identify the owner of the private keys. And as we have seen, what I've read about the current case as described in the New York Times, what it seemed to me there was that this couple were really rather careless in other bank accounts transfers that they made. And if, of course, you can be identified through the dark web, as I understand it, and you can get your IP address, then you can identify the holder of the private key. And that has been done in some cases. But I think it's moved from being impossible to much more difficult, time-consuming, and expensive because of the people you have to hire to do it.
Yeah. So to answer Jeffrey, I would say that you're generally correct. I've talked to several law enforcement officers, federal law enforcement officers, who tell me how much more they prefer working on cryptocurrency cases where they have access to the blockchain in which every transaction is recorded and it's a permanent record that criminals leave behind of their transactions. And it's actually quite easily and inexpensive to trace all the transactions. The trick is tying an real-world identity to the records on the blockchain. And this actually presents the same problem that we have with the legacy financial system. So it used to be the case that law enforcement would have a suspect, and the suspect would have a bank account, and they would know who the suspect was, but not know what the suspect's transactions were. And so they would have to go get a warrant or a subpoena to go to the bank and say, hey, here's our suspect. What are this person's transactions? Today, what they have is the inverse. They have all the transactions, right? They can go to a dark web market, see all of the drug sales, see all the transactions, but they don't know who it is. So what they can do now is take the transactions and go to a cryptocurrency exchange and say, who is the person associated with these? And using a blockchain forensic software, it's actually not that difficult to identify which addresses are associated with which exchanges, so they can go and see. And of course, this is why you want to have good regulation for exchanges. So those are going to be subject to Bank Secrecy Act regulation, et cetera. Let's see. Question from
Gary.
Yeah.
I think we have an audience member, Jessica Kong, who's raised her hand.
Okay, great.
Hi, Jerry. Hi, Dr. McDonald. Can you hear me okay?
We hear you.
Oh, great. Okay. Thanks for hosting this event. I guess my question, I had a comment before when you were talking about central bank digital currencies. And Dr. McDonald, I think it's important. You highlighted how setup is important, but then you talked about the intent for setting up a CBDC as one major reason of sort of why you would go against the idea of one. And then I was thinking about, and I definitely agree with China, sort of like the privacy concern and having more control and access. But I also was thinking about how China, as well as Sweden with the e-krona, they're experiencing like a large reduction in the use of cash. And so when their economies are more digital, I guess it's a central bank's question on how do we address this when your monetary policy tools don't really have control in a cashless economy. So I don't know if the argument there is for if your country is experiencing that, like in Sweden, if it's sort of arguing that there shouldn't be a central bank role in helping to support financial markets. And then I also think about like in the Bahamas with the sand dollar, that they've implemented that to help rural populations that don't really have access to these sort of means. And while there's definitely like private organizations that you show, like M-Pesa in Kenya has been tremendously successful to help alleviate poverty. And so we see that private industry can help be the solution. But then is that to say that the central bank should rely on the private industry for those sort of cases?
Well, as indeed the central bank relies on commercial banks as an essential part of the economy. If you give all of that totally to a central bank, then I'm not suggesting that this would be immediately misused, but there are always circumstances in which a temptation would be there for elected officials and for the governor of the central bank so to use it. And that, I think, is the danger. It's very interesting that that given the level of distrust in America of a central bank, which is higher than in other countries, other advanced countries, that anyone here should contemplate the notion of the Federal Reserve issuing a CBDC. You can't, it's very difficult to prevent the central bank from having clear access to the transactions that are taking place. This is done in, as it were, bulk form at the moment, but not which individual is spending what on what. And I do think that that's a real danger. And by the way, even in Sweden, where the introduction of CBDC is subject to a parliamentary commission, which doesn't report till November this year. Mm-hmm. And yes, there has been considerable decline of cash. There are strong arguments from public and public representing particularly sections of the population, such as elderly people, are against the total digitalization of their currency, which is interesting. And remember the example I just gave you of the Ukraine. There are times when you want cash and only cash will do because the systems break down, not accidentally, but they are being destroyed, as they will be in Ukraine.
All right. Well, I think that is all the time we have. Dr. McDonald, thank you so much for having this conversation, and I'll turn it back to Nate.
Yes, I wish we had more time. This has been, I think, as advertised, an excellent conversation, and we are certainly grateful to Jerry and Una for the benefit of their expertise today. Again, Dr. McDonald's new book is Cryptocurrencies, Money, Trust, and Regulation. To learn more about it, you can visit the link we've provided for you in the description of today's program. We welcome audience feedback by email at rtp@regproject.org. Thank you all. Have a great one.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.